So good evening, everyone. Venerable Children will probably be back next week. She taught twice today, and so and we hadn't actually finished last time the chapter that we were working on, so we'll continue with that tonight. So we'll start by setting our motivation. And sitting here, I was again remembering what Geshe Dadul said when he was here. We were speaking and he was saying, oh, I hear that you're studying debate. And then the first thing he said to me was how appreciative he was of all the people that were his classmates and how much he learned from them and how much they taught each other. And I can really see how that is the case because we correct each other and bring out more points and people send in emails and ask questions or give, you know, more information, and I really appreciate that and enjoy this process. And so as we turn our minds to this topic, it gets, for me, helpful to remember that I'm not always so logical and I'm not always seeing things so clearly, and I even watch it when, like, we're doing these classes, all of a sudden my mind gets kind of stuck in a certain way of thinking, and I can't solve what we're looking at, and it's very similar to just how the mind gets stuck when we're not seeing reality clearly, which is, you know, all the time. So, seeing how useful it is to be leading our lives in a way that's based on some kind of reasoning and not just kind of gliding through on automatic or being pulled around by our emotions all the time. I appreciate the emotions that I have and I like to use them, the ones that are wholesome, but the ones that aren't, I really could do without. And without some kind of logic in my life and reasoning, I probably wouldn't feel that, think that way. So just appreciating our opportunity and seeing it as part of our path to full awakening. And then really bringing into mind why we're doing this to help us to become Buddhas, to help us to realize the nature of reality so that we can do that. And then always keeping all sentient beings in mind so that we can have a very large perspective about what we're doing and why we're doing it, to relieve the suffering of all beings. Let's take a moment to turn our mind that way and have that be our motivation for what we're doing. So for those of you who are using books, last time we got to the section that starts with comments on page 63. And so we'll start with that and then work through that, and then there see a couple emails that came in that I wanted to respond to, and then I'd like to go back and do some exercises together, and hopefully we'll have time for all of that. So, where am I on my notes? Oh, sure. If you're using an ebook, you'll want to find analytical thinking of all sorts depends. So we'll start right in to the text. And it says, analytical thinking of all sorts depends on this comparative approach to learning. So here, Daniel Perdue is making a lot of comments to us. So starting to put this in perspective. Knowing the boundaries of pervasion of a thing, its range in the world, informs us about what is possible. You may think of it as learning the meaning of words, but the light of learning illuminates more than semantics. Analytical understanding begins with observation. Then we learn the details, and then we see patterns. Understanding this in distinction to that, and understanding this, that this and that are alike in some way, are essential tools in this investigation. So as he said in the introduction, this is a way of developing our critical thinking. And it's interesting that it's all about looking at the range of things and how things relate to each other. And yeah, And maybe you see that in your own experience. I was thinking about when we do our meditation practice, we start observing a lot of things, then we start learning the details of them, and then we start seeing the patterns in our own mind, at least about how the afflictions work. And that's quite helpful because you don't have to then learn everything individually and start kind of seeing patterns and working with things. But are these real things that are being compared, or is this just some intellectual sleight of hand? The things that are being compared are as real as you are and as close as your breath. How far do you have to reach out to contact something that is impermanent? Not too far. And what would you reach with? And what would you reach with other than something that is impermanent, like your hand? It's about these things. And I think it's important that he does this because both the subjects as well as the collective entities is the word that are what encompass those subjects. It's easy, I find, to get confused about, actually. So he's trying to point out that when we populate these, you know, when we compare these two things and we're looking at all those examples in there, those are real things that we're talking about. You know, they're trying to tell us to use specific subjects as well. Because sometimes when we do this, we just say something kind of vague, like blue, rather than this blue shirt, you know, things like that. I think we sometimes get into trouble by not populating those sets more specifically. So it's about real things, things that you can reach out and touch. So exactly what is being compared in this process? In the analytical comparison of two phenomena, P and Q are predicates or qualities, as a man has the quality of being a person. So I looked up predicate in the dictionary because that word is not a word I would generally use. And in logic, it had two meanings that kind of apply here or come. One sentence that was given that had two meanings, one in logic and one in grammar, part of that seems to apply here. And it said, state, affirm, or assert something about the subject in a sentence, so that's kind of the grammar part, or an argument of proposition. So to state, affirm, or assert something in an argument, proposition, about the subject in an argument, a proposition. So as he's saying, this is about qualities. And in our text, it says the predicate is a quality of the subject or something that can be ascribed to the subject. So at this point, I think it's good if we keep it that general. I think that's enough. When you go into the next chapter, once they start talking about syllogisms, then this word's all over the place in this text. And it will, but it's never actually defined in this text more than that. It will just be used in syllogisms and it will be quite evident what we're doing there. But for me, I need more of just what does that word mean? Because it's not a word that I use. And sometimes when they're using it, it's like, I don't know what they're talking about. Always, when it's in the syllogism, it makes sense, but they don't always use it in that context. So it's a quality of the subject or something that can be ascribed to the subject. So here, going back to the text, the question is about what subjects have P as a predicate. So what subjects have these qualities? And what subjects have Q as a predicate? What subjects have Q as, you know, whatever qualities we're talking about? So thinking of the full range of things inside the bubble of P and the full range of things inside the bubble of Q, remember what we're doing here, right? We're always comparing two things, never more than two. We label one P and one Q, whatever it is, and then we populate those with examples of each, and then we're looking at how they compare. So the process is to consider how these two spheres of phenomena compare to each other. Is one wholly included in the other? Are they exactly the same? Do they overlap at all? The answer has to be one of the ways shown above, which we've kind of gone through the ones that were, I think the first one we did was three possibilities, where one was a subset wholly enclosed in the other, so a small circle and a big circle. Then the next one we did was four possibilities, which was two circles that are like that, you know, some things were and some things weren't. And then we did mutually exclusive, which are two circles that are separate, and then mutually inclusive, which are two circles on top of each other. That's what we've been shown. Okay, so the principles being compared are collective entities. And then he doesn't say anything more about that. That's good, because that's a confusing topic. And we don't want to go there yet. We figure out how the spheres relate by testing particular examples of things that have the qualities of the two circles. We ask whether or not there is anything in the real world that may accurately be said to have both qualities. The answer to that then implies whether or not we may accurately use those terms as predicates in a sentence, such as, the subject and X is both a P and a Q. So let's do an example, like the subject and apple is both a fruit and an impermanent phenomena. So if you were comparing fruit and impermanent phenomena, those would be your two circles. And you could say the subject and apple is both a fruit and an impermanent phenomena. Thus, the point of the comparison between two principles is those two as predicates of real things in the world. And the comparison is verified by testing exemplifications or representations of those two, of those qualities. The process is not at all strange. It is something people do all the world over. It is just one of the ways we learn. However, this process in Buddhist reasoning and debate gives imagery to learning in a very natural way. We'll see when I tried to come up with examples that they had in some of the homework. I didn't find it all that easily. But I need to tune my ears more. So he gives us some examples. So if we're doing this all over the world, how have we traditionally done it in English? I have listened for years trying to capture native specimens. That's what we need to do. We need to like bring this into our daily life and find the specimens. So he says, I think that generally we do this using plurals. So now he's just talking about the language, because he had a big hard time, you know, with, in all of the previous book debate, he made these collective entities singular. And here in this book, he's chosen to make them plural because it's much more natural to how they speak. So he's going to spend some time on this. So he hears things like, I don't think dinosaurs and birds are at all alike. I don't think dinosaurs and birds are all alike. Each of those is a collective entity, dinosaurs and birds. You're not talking about a specific dinosaur and a specific bird. You're not talking about a subject in that. You're talking about the collective entity of dinosaurs, birds. And, you know, birds are, what, they come from dinosaurs? I don't know my elementary school thing, but I know they're related, because in the back row. Yes?
The theory is that the dinosaurs evolved.
Yes, that's what I was thinking. Birds evolved from dinosaurs. Yeah, they had these flying dinosaurs, right? Do you remember? Weren't you there? And then the next one is, some teas are more aromatic than others. I think a lot of people here probably say that. Russians don't necessarily live in Russia. So in both these examples, the collective entity is a plural. That's how we generally use things in our language. Sometimes it doesn't work, as we've seen. Therefore, I have switched to the use of plurals for the analytical comparison of phenomena. In Debate in Tibetan Buddhism, this previous book, I expressed the two principles of a comparison with the singular terms, saying, for instance, how do functioning thing and existent compare? And, I mean, you can get used to that, but it's a lot easier to speak with our native language, I would say. However, years of instructing new debaters in English have shown me that this is not the natural way we tend to pose a question of the comparison of phenomena. Rather, we tend to express the principles as plurals and say, for instance, how do functioning things in existence compare? TS, existence. So that's much more natural. In the earlier book, I did not use the plurals because I feared they would imply that there would be three possibilities between each and every functioning thing and each and every existent. However, that is not true because, for instance, there are not three possibilities between impermanent phenomena and functioning things. So, in practice on the ground, I have discovered that the use of plurals to express the two principles in a comparison of phenomena does not convey what I feared and what I sought to avoid. So using what is natural speech in English trumps this qualm I had earlier. Does everybody follow that? It's kind of easy for us, but if you read through that book, it's not so easy because the way language is used is so different from how we usually speak that it was easy to get... Well, they go through a lot of debates. That previous book he wrote is like 880 pages at least, and they go through a lot of debates in there, and you read these debates and you're kind of like, and they get really convoluted in certain ways. Some of them are twists on Tibetan language, some of them are just all these things, and you're kind of like, what are they talking about here? And you have to read them each, you know, three times to figure it out. And so it's kind of a joy that the English is, now I'm not having to struggle with the language. You know, he's made this quite clear here because this took a lot of time to figure out. Okay, so here's one that we get to do. These next two exercises, exercise 4.8. Listen quietly to people talking and try to capture whether or not they're ever engaged in the process of comparing phenomena in any way similar to this process. Pay attention to what you read and what you're saying and see if this process applies. So that's part of our homework, unless you've already done it. And then you can bring examples, because in the next one, we're going to do that. Find at least one natural species specimen where someone, including yourself, makes a mistake in the comparison of phenomena. Listen for it in films, television, music, and speech. Capture that specimen and write it down on a piece of paper. Draw the circles and explain the mistake. I don't actually find this very easy. So what I did is I went online and looked up lyrics or what was it? Quotes and love songs. Because I like love songs, they always have things put together that don't really jive. So I thought, well, that'll be easy. And it was kind of, but then I thought, oh, this is a monastic crowd. We can't have just that. So then we went on to, you came in and you said country. Yeah, and then we went on to something else. So anyway, here's one. How about this? All of me loves all of you. We're comparing. All of me loves all of you. I don't know if I can even do this, but it seemed like a kind of a good choice. How would you compare that? I don't know. Maybe it's not a great example, but it seems kind of like, yeah.
I have one.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Great. Perfect.
We just thought about
it. Okay. Oh, isn't it the Frank Sinatra song? Love and marriage, they go together like a horse and carriage. Do they always go together, yeah. Love and marriage?
No. Okay. Let's see. Was this the one you gave me? The day you stop looking back is the day you start? Or is that one I picked? The day you stop looking back is the day you start. What do you think? Comparing the day you stop looking back is the day you start. Well, you could remain in neutral if you think of it like a car. When you're not backing up, looking backwards, you could go forwards.
How I heard that was, yeah. The day you're not...
The day you stop looking back.
The day you stop looking back. So the day that you stop living in the past or in your memories is the day that you're present. So you start from there.
Oh, you start from there. We're trying to look at things that just come up naturally and see how people are comparing two things. And do they actually have the same qualities? Like... To me, I would say, like, for that one, yeah, I get it, what she's saying there, the meaning of that. But when I think of it in terms of logic, okay, sometimes I'm not, if I don't dwell on the past, it doesn't mean that I'm necessarily going to be the day I start and move forward. I might not dwell on the past just because I'm unconscious. You know, there could be a lot of reasons why you don't dwell on the past. So you have to populate the, you know, see how these two phenomena compare is what we're trying to do. We're trying to use just natural things that we hear in speech and see how do these two things compare. And there's the one where both those things happen, where you stop thinking about the past and now you're in the present. So I would say it might have four possibilities, you know, and that would be one. And then it would be one where you stop looking in the past, but you aren't really, it isn't the day you start, because maybe you're not looking in the past just because you're not looking. Yeah, because you're looking in the future. That's why I was using the thing of the car. You could be a new, like if I think of it like a car, okay, I'm not backing up, but that could be I'm either in neutral or going forward. It's not necessarily that the day you start to me meant like you're moving forward. So I made it like a car analogy to try to understand it. So we're just kind of playing here. So let your minds be loose.
So that phrase is implying that those two are mutually inclusive. And
right.
You're saying that there's four possibilities.
Yes, exactly. And the same with all of me loves all of you. Really? All of me loves all of you? Does that mean I don't love anyone else? You know, is there... Yeah, right. I don't know. It's funny. Here's the last one. And you can see, maybe you have some. I'm always tired, but never of you. I like this. This is like some country song. Country. We went into the country music. They had the best ones. I'm always tired, but never of you. How do you think that one relates? Always tired? I mean, it's like these should be mutually exclusive or something. I don't know.
I was thinking of that Beatles song, 8 days a week.
Yeah.
8 days a week is not enough to show I care. Or like,
yeah. Yeah. Anyway, it's kind of hard to do it with this, but we can try.
How about warm hands means warm heart?
Yeah, there you go. Comparing warm hands and warm heart. Yeah, it can be. And it can't be. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah, go ahead. So anyway, we want to do this a little bit so we actually start listening.
Almost any opinion that's like not a fact. You know, if you say pizza is gross, I mean, how can you validate that, really? I mean, it depends on the person you ask.
Yeah, right. That's why, going back to his examples, I mean, like, I don't know, that makes me think of some teas are more aromatic than others. Well, that's a little easier than some people's opinions.
Yeah, you can have an objective standard, you know, like based on aromaness or whatever.
So anyway, what we want to try to do from this is we want to try to listen and see what are we actually doing. Go ahead. That's what I think the point of this.
But you could find a lot in the political rhetoric.
Oh, yeah.
Like, for instance, one I read today was newspapers are the enemy of the public.
I got into a debate with someone about skillful means and versus intention. And then the person I was talking to asked, well, are you going to believe the Irish or are you going to believe the Buddha? And that struck me as very funny. Because I said, like, there's an Irish saying that the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Oh.
I think that sort of intention isn't enough without skillful means.
Then
the response was, are you going to believe the Irish or are you going to believe the Buddha?
Yeah, there we go. There's some example.
There's plenty of overlap.
Yeah, there we go. You had something too.
I don't know if this is directly relevant, but I think a lot of bad policy decisions are made based on this sort of fallacies too. Like, you know, the one I worked on was most crimes are committed by foreigners. And then we look at the police data. This is Singapore. Then you look at the police data, it does not bear out.
Yeah, same in the United States. Yeah. It's actually very much true in the United States too, but you won't convince a lot of people who watch the news, and the presentations on the news aren't very... Not sure if it's always reflective of the reality. Okay, so then he goes on with some advice. The comparison of phenomena is probably the single most important tool in Buddhist reasoning and debate. And here are some guidelines. What is the internal procedure for thinking about how two things compare? It seems that the internal procedure is not codified. although in such a broad tradition, he's talking about the scholarly tradition of debate, many must have given advice over the years. I do not recall ever getting any instruction myself. Even so, here is what seems a rational procedure. First, spend just a moment pondering over the P phenomena, thinking of all the things that may be said to have that as a quality, and then do the same for the Q phenomenon. So we might think about how do blue and the colors of the of cloth compare. So, because it's easier to think of real things. So how do blue, the P phenomena, and all the things that might have that quality, kind of picture that in your mind. And then think about the colors of cloth and all the things that might, entail. So you just do this internally. He's telling to teach us how to do this debate now that he's gotten us taught the four, you know, comparisons and the six variations that they use. And now he's kind of, now that we've played around with enough, he's trying to give us some advice about how to do this. So he's saying, hey, first spend some time looking at all the P phenomena and thinking of all the things that may be said to have that as a quality, and then do the same for the Q. These reflections should rough in the boundaries of pervasion for each of the two. I think of these boundaries of pervasion as like circles that contain all the P phenomena or Q phenomena, rather than as borders like the one between the United States and Mexico. So you might remember that when we did this before, blue and the color of cloth had four possibilities. So it's the two circles that were like this, right? So what's something that's both blue and the color of cloth? The blue jacket of the Anagarika suit. Yep, that's right. What is something that is blue but not the color of cloth? A blue sky. Yep. Or a blue sapphire. Somebody wrote me a question about this. I realized I didn't know what color sapphires were. I had to look it up. I thought. Yeah, I think it's better to say the color of the blue sky. Did you say? I'm not sure what you said.
I didn't say that.
Yeah, it's better to say the color of a blue sky for sure. And he'll explain that later. And then what would be the color of a color of cloth, but not blue? The color of the chugu, which is kind of yellow to orange. Yeah. And then what is outside of those? What is neither the color of cloth nor blue? The color of the forester. What color is that? The color is white. Yeah, but it's not cloth. So I think the answer in the book is like the color of ruby. Let's look it up, because this is the one that the person had a question about. Does it say the color of a red ruby, or does it say a red ruby? That's the thing that it... Oh, that's interesting. What page are you on? You might not know. It's 4-4. Because they made a chart on this one. And yeah, I think it can be because, yeah, it's on 52. And this is the one that somebody had a question about. I think that we might have misspoken once in here, but I don't think, I was thinking, I did last week and you corrected me, but I don't think that was it because I remember what my error was. But I might have been, I don't know. But at any rate, when you're comparing these two, blue and the colors of cloth, you can, the color of cloth has to be the color of cloth. So the color of a car isn't the color of cloth. Or the color of a gym isn't the color of cloth, because it's not cloth. So it's very specific. If you have the, if you have a circle and you have all the colors of cloth there, and then you have another circle and they're like this, and this is how I understand it. You can correct me if I'm wrong. And then you have blue. Then the only thing that is both, of course, is like the blue shirt. And we've gone through the other two. But what is neither, the example that gives the color of a ruby, because the color of a ruby is not blue and it's not the color of a cloth. Because it's not a cloth.
But couldn't that exact color be?
Yes, it could be. It could have the same exact color as you're asking, but it's not the color of a cloth. You see what I'm saying? Because that's how specific that what's the word they're using? Collective entity is, I believe. That's how I understand this.
One of the things that you have to think about is he's talking specifically of subjects. So he's talking about, something about not everything that you're comparing results in an exemplar of that thing. So in the same way, even though it's possible to have a piece of cloth that is the same color as your ruby, the color of your ruby, it's still, the ruby is not a cloth.
You won't find the ruby in that circle.
You won't find the ruby because
it's not one of the
cloth.
Subjects.
Yes,
you could find that color, but you wouldn't find it in that circle because it's not a color of a cloth.
Because in that particular instance, the ruby is not cloth. That's the meaning of the color of cloth. It's not saying, what are all the possible colors of cloth? That's not the comparison. It's not the comparison of all the possible colors of that a cloth could be dyed or a cloth could appear. It's saying, what is something, what is a color of something that's not a piece of cloth.
Well, they could have given an example that was quite different, like the forester.
But
I would think of it this way. Like if we go into Joanne's Fabrics and you say all the colors of cloth here, it has to be one of these bolts that you're going to pull out. That's what's populating that circle. And then when you go outside and you find a ruby and you say, wow, that ruby is the same color as that cloth, but it's not in that. It's not cloth, you know? I think it's like that. We're talking about real things. This is where I think he's really helping us. It seems so easy what we're reading, but this is exactly why we have to keep going back and reading him, because he's making it so well. This is how we get, you know, this is what he's trying to teach us here. So anyway, you could debate this a lot of ways, but I'll go with the way he did it in the book, and that's what he has. And I think that kind of, I think the reasoning that we're giving seems to work.
I'm unconvinced.
Okay.
Read this sentence that I have highlighted right here.
Yeah, good. Let's keep going.
Why is the color of my blue T-shirt a color of cloth? Why? Because of being the color of a blue T-shirt. Yeah, and in here he's talking about giving very specific examples.
Right.
But if you had another object that was that exact color, you're talking about the color, not the object. They could have been dyed with the same thing. I could dye my hands with the same color you dye the blue shirt, and it's the same color. That's
yeah,
what
the color
I'm not
is the
convinced.
Same. Yeah, we're not disagreeing about
that. We're not talking
that.
About the ruby. We're talking about the color of the ruby.
Well, that's where I think where we differ. We're talking about the thing. Yeah.
In the collective entity that you have, color of cloth, you will only have colors of cloth. Cloths with colors.
Yeah, cloths with colors.
So like yellow cloth, blue cloth, or the color of yellow cloth, the color of blue cloth. It's more about the entity cloth that has the color. It's not about the color, just the color. It's about the cloth that has the color.
Right.
So you won't find a ruby in that collection because a ruby is not cloth. Does that help? We're talking about cloth. Only thing in that category is cloth. And cloths have different colors.
But it doesn't say cloth and its color. It says the color of cloth.
Yes, it does.
And the color is a color.
Yeah,
and the
that's
color
true.
Of a ruby
what you're
is
saying
a color.
Is true, but I think you're getting stuck in the semantics rather than what the comparison
What's
is.
What's meant there?
The comparison. What is what is being compared? See, I think you're getting stuck
then
in the semantics.
Then what did you say
moment.
Was both?
The color of an anagarika cloth.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a color blue.
Yeah, it is the color, but it's a cloth that's the color blue. If we take away, let's take away the debate language for a sec, because I think it's the language here that's getting us a little, you know, we don't speak this way naturally. We usually don't bother with saying the color of, but you have to in this language, because when you're talking about the, you know, as they've told us before, the car is just a bunch of metal, you know, and so you have to say it's the color of. But we don't really speak that way. So when this is where the mind, I find my mind going back and forth in these, and this is how I got mixed up last week, because you watch your mind going back and forth. And so you have to think about what is in those circles and what are you populating it with. It's cloth that has different colors. And then the language we're going to use in debate is we're going to say that we're going to compare the color, a quality of those, the color of that cloth, and we're going to compare it with something else. So only thing that's in there is, like you went into Joanne's fabrics, bunches of bolts of cloth. That's what they're trying to do here. And then if you wanted just to compare colors, you could do that. But it would be a different, I think it would have to be a different subject. It would be like colors and blue. That's what I think. You can don't need to agree with me. I'm just telling you how I understand this. Yeah. So anyway, let's keep going and maybe it will help, because he gets into this where we get tied up. And then I think for Ramesh, I think we answered your question. And I think that someone, I don't know who, we probably mixed this up, and if we corrected it, you didn't hear it. So I think everything you sent it to me is correct, and I think we're all on the same page, matching ourselves with what it says in the book on this. So that's one of our two questions. And then, okay, we'll go on and see. And, you know, as the way to look at this, I think, is that there aren't right or wrong answers. The way to look at it is what Geshe Wangmo says. Oh, we can debate that. This is the way I like to look at this. And so, you know, we can debate that. And then let's see who can get it there to shake out, you know. I think that, you know, I think what I understand is what he's doing here. It makes sense to me.
So the way that I'm approaching this is I am trying to understand a system of thought, a system of thought.
Right.
So I may have other systems like, you know, physics or biology or something that I've learned in a different situation. And so when I look at what they're saying, he's giving me an example, you know, like the color of the red ruby.
Right.
Right. Okay. So then when I look at that, I say, okay, so in his system, that's a true statement. In the system that you're talking about, you know, you might even say, for me to paraphrase what you're saying, there's a certain wavelength of light that we label red, and that same wavelength of light can come off a piece of cloth and can come off a ruby, and that's what you're asserting. But that's a different system. That's not the system that he's trying to teach us. So I have to, like, give up my other systems that I have assertions in and try to understand, open my mind to understand the system that Daniel is presenting to me. And, you know, in the universe, I may not agree with something that he's saying, you know, but I'm trying to understand his system. So when he says, you know, when he's saying something that, you know, like we had the other problem where they had the diagrams and the letters were backwards.
Right.
So we realized that. We said, okay, that's not what Daniel's meaning. But in this case, it's very clear what he's meaning. So I have to give up my understanding of wavelengths and colors and try to understand the system that he's trying to present to me. And then when I understand his system, then I can look at my other ways of thinking and decide whether I'm going to follow his system to a certain extent, or if I'm just going to reject his system and go with some other system that I like better. But until I really understand his system, I have to give up my ideas that are contrary to what I'm reading.
I am actually trying to work out of this system. And when we say a white horse is not white, because the object is not the color, and that's what I'm going on. The cloth is not the color. The color and the cloth are distinct entities. The ruby and the color are not the same. They're distinct entities. That's why I'm saying it. It's distinctly saying not cloth, not a colored cloth, the color of the cloth. That is how this system states it when it talks about the white horse, you know? And that's what I'm going on. And so that's what it seemed to me. But like I said, I just said that I was unconvinced. I didn't expect to go into it any more than that. And I'm still unconvinced.
Okay, let's go on. Okay, so where were we? So we're on now. Next, look to see if these two circles overlap at all. Is there anything that is both a P and a Q, a common locus of the two phenomena? If not, you know the two phenomena being compared are mutually exclusive. So this is all review now. If they do overlap, then wonder whether or not the circle of one of the two phenomena is wholly included in the circle of the other phenomena. So if the inclusion goes both ways, so that every P is a Q and every Q is a P, then the two are mutually inclusive. If the inclusion goes only one way, so that every P is a Q, but it's not the case that every Q is a P, then there are three possibilities. That's where one is a subset of the other. At this point, you almost never need to wonder if there is something that is neither, unless one of the principles is the selfless or something else that refers to everything imaginable. If the boundaries of pervasion of the two phenomena overlap so that there is a common locus of the two, but there's no pervasion between P and Q, that is, if it is not the case that whatever is a P is necessarily a Q, and is not also the case that whatever is a Q is necessarily a P, then they compare as four possibilities, this is all review. So at this point, the wise will glance to see whether or not there is something that is neither a P nor a Q to determine if the answer should be four possibilities without neither. So that's, and he says, I never seem to be able to remember to do this. Yeah, so do I. I have a hard time thinking that way sometimes. This is where I watch my mind go with this. Like, I'm thinking so much about these things that are in the circles that becomes like the whole universe, and I forget, oh yeah, there's things outside of that. That's what happened last week. Okay, so that's his first piece of advice. The second is avoid the area of error of thinking that the process is about a shared attribute of the two principles. Rather, it is whether or not there is something that is both of them. Very often for beginners first exposed to this way of thinking, what they need to be thinking about seems to come into and go out of focus. That's what I find. They will think, for instance, that permanent phenomena and impermanent phenomena have a common locus because both are existence. There is no common locus of a permanent phenomena and the impermanent phenomena because there is nothing that is both permanent and impermanent. This might be what we're coming up on the example that we just did. A shared attribute rather than something. This is the going back to the objects. So he explains this a little bit more. Or they will think that there is an overlap between humans and cats because they are both carbon-based life forms, for instance. But there is no overlap because there is nothing that is both a cat and a human. You will see the problem here is that if you think like this, then you have three circles: cats, humans, and carbon-based life forms, rather than the required two circles. Cats and humans would be little circles inside of the larger circle of carbon-based life forms. So that's where something to look at. I think we've done that a number of times when we had our class and we got kind of mixed up on things. Does everybody follow this? So the thing is not a shared attribute of the two, but something that is both of them. Yeah, an instance. Yeah.
We're going to skip over this one, but how do the two compare the color red and redness? Because redness would be a permanent phenomena, no?
I don't know. How do you define redness?
Having the quality of being red.
If redness is a hue, then it's the same. If redness is, you know what I mean? If redness is a hue, then it's the same as a color. It's just you're using a synonym, and they're referring to the same, at least the color is the same. But one is just talking about color, and the other was the red what? The color red. Yeah, so I think I would see those as synonyms, and they're referring to the same thing. It's just two words that are possibly referring to the same thing, depending on how you define them. So, because if you say they're both a hue, then that's what the definition of a color, that which is suitable as a hue, I think. Okay, yeah. That's interesting. Gets you thinking. Recall that in my comments above, in the issue of what is being compared in the comparison of phenomena, I settled on saying that it is the qualities of the individuals within the collective entities. The issue is not about the class P as a whole, but about all of the individual members that are P. As I will show later, it may be that the group as a whole has a quality that is not shared by every member of the group. So this is an easy one that I can give an example of. If you use something in this system, let's see, if you use something that, like, say, existent, things that exist, and existent, that has examples that are both permanent and impermanent phenomena, right? Impermanent phenomena exist and permanent phenomena exist. So if you use, those are like, those would both be, there would be things that would be impermanent phenomena, like most of the stuff on this table, and there would be things that are permanent phenomena, like the emptiness of everything on this table, and they would all be in that circle of existence, objects of knowledge. But the group as a whole, the collective entity, objects of knowledge, is in this system considered permanent. But it's, whenever you have both permanent and impermanent instances, then you designate that collective entity permanent. So that's what, that would be one example here of, let's see, I will show later that it may be that the group as a whole has a quality that's not shared by every member of the group. So the way they designate object of knowledge is permanent. But not every object of knowledge is permanent. Some of them are impermanent. That's an example. Indeed, it even occurs that sometimes the group as a whole has no has a quality that no member of the group has. And that, I bet, goes to some of these crazy examples of, like, isolates or something, would be my guess. But we're not going there tonight. That would, this book, like, we've already gone forward into stuff that's way farther on in this book, so we're just trying to keep it simple and get the basic ideas here. Inside of each circle P, imagine 1,000 little circles or little points, each of which stands for something that is a P. In some circles, there would be far more than 1,000. In some, there would be only one. Among all of those things that are P's, are there any that are also Q's? So this is where I kind of follow what you're saying. It's a little hard to think sometimes when you're sitting up here. But for me, this is what I, how I understand this is you always have to pick the items, the things. You know, that's why I was using the example of like the bolts of cloth. They have to be things. So not a quality of it, which is, so I don't know, maybe we'll sort that out down the line. If so, that is what you need to focus on, not whether or not there's anything that P and Q have in common. Everybody following that? How do you think that relates to the debate we had? Do we have, we clarified it? For me, this kind of clarifies the issue, but I'm not sure. Or are we too bummed out to go there because of, can we still think and have fun, or are we going to sink?
What's interesting is that, you know, you're comparing categories, but the categories are not the things that they're
right.
made up
this
of.
This is what's interesting about this.
So, it, but earlier you said this refers to real things.
Right.
And
you're actually comparing, what he's saying is you're comparing the instances, or you would say maybe the members in there, the things that are, the real things. So this is what, one thing I talked to Geshe Daldo about. I was saying to him, he wouldn't explain it all to me because I asked him the same question the last time he was here, and he's kind of strict that way. I already explained that to you. I'm like still lost in the same exact way. But he did tell me one thing that helped. For example, if you were talking about chairs, you know, let's compare chairs and something else. So chairs is a collective entity, right? That collective entity, you can't sit on it. Or if you're comparing apples with oranges, the collective entity apples exists, but you can't chew one. All of the instances inside there are all the different kinds of apples, but the collective entity is not something you can eat. That's as far as he would answer it. This is not, we're not going to go too far in this. I'll let you ponder that. But what we are comparing, and right now when we're doing these two comparisons, we're not comparing the collective entities. We're comparing what he's saying there, the things in there. So how those two relate, the collective entity and what's in there, is actually a very important topic in the book I was speaking about, Knowledge and Liberation. Explains why this is important, and I'll just give you what I got from it, and don't quote me on this, because sometimes I don't know how to use some of these terms. Like, I would call that a generality, but I'm not sure sometimes, because these words are so, when you read that whole debate book, until you're really good at this, you're never too sure. But I can say this in terms of a generality. The reason this is important is because when the Buddha was living, there were people who believed in a soul, right? And so this whole topic of generalities and all this, it relates to this almost like it's also the topic of wholes and parts. The same things comes in. It's like, if you think that when you're talking about a person and inside is the body and the mind, and that generality can exist completely separate from the body and mind, then you can have an Atman. But if you think that they only can be, that they can't be separate, they have to, you know, that they have to be together. I'm not using the right words here exactly. Yeah. Let's see. What did they say? I'm forgetting the exact word, so I don't want to take it any farther. But to have an Atman, you have a situation where you have a generality that it can exist on its own, separate from the instances. And when you have that, you're allowing for like an Atman, because what's inside, you know, if you have a person and what's inside is the body, what makes it up is the body and the mind, you're able to, you know, you could posit, but the Buddhists shoot that down. I don't have this down enough to use the words, but I think I can convey the idea there. Why this matters? Why would we, for me it's important, like, why do some of these things matter? And some of them matter because they actually end up being easier examples of things that are actually more important to us. So like the one with the space, you know, that's an easier example for us to understand. And that one, she explains in that book, is an example of the uncaused space or the uncompounded space, is an example of something that is permanent, that exists. But there was actually a whole lot of belief, and there still is, even in other schools, the way they define things, of other Indian philosophical schools and even other Buddhist schools, I would say, where there is the thought that the only thing that exists are impermanent phenomena. Well, if that's the case, then emptiness doesn't exist. Now the nature of reality doesn't exist. So this is what they're kind of explaining in that book that I'm reading. And so I get kind of the big picture things, but I'm not so to explain it, you know, in the great detail that somebody who write these geshes who explain this to her is way beyond what I can do. But I get the, you know, why these things are important. And so we work with the example of uncompounded space is much easier for us to wrap our minds around. We can know what that is. We can define that, you know, the lack of obstructability. We can get that conceptually. Now when we try to apply that to emptiness, well, we don't really get what emptiness is, so we can't, it's a harder, you always want to use an illustration that's easier than what you're working on. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does. But the reason I ask is because the thing about there can be members of the group that don't have the quality.
Right.
But the group is dependent on its members, or it's rather, it is kind of. Like, how could you have that distinction?
I think there'll be a lot of examples brought up. I'm not going to spend more time on that tonight. I've explained the one that I could, but quite easily, and that's as far as I'm going to take it. Yeah, the one where it doesn't have any is probably this one that has to do with, I would guess, but it would be a waste of time to go into it because it'd just be a guess. It'd be one of these kind of concepts, that things that, like, what isolates are, I think, or something like that. And that's, you know, we're not going there. I don't even know if he gets into it in this text, to tell you the truth. So it will just be something you'll have to wait. Read the book Debate and you'll find one. It'll be in there. Okay. What are we doing there? Okay. Well, maybe we'll get through these. We will not worry about the other stuff. Okay, number three, don't worry about being wrong. It's, to some extent, nothing ventured, nothing gained. You have to try, and you have to be brave. Of course, if you are just firing off into the night just to have something to say, no one will want to debate with you or even pay attention to you. However, if you are so afraid to be wrong that it blocks you, you will not progress well. Just let the barriers down. One of the things I like about debate classes is that the pretense has to drop away. After a while, in every debate class, we all know the relative rankings of every student in the class, at least into 3 to 5 groups. I think that the number one obstacle to learning is the refusal to admit that you do not know. If a cup is already full, you cannot pour anything into it. So yeah, basically, if we think we know everything, we aren't going to learn from others. That's one thing that Geshe Dajo was so great about. You know, he's like, I learn. He learns from everyone he meets. Everyone. So he doesn't put himself above anyone, so then he can learn from everyone. You have to, you know how it is. If you don't have respect for someone, you actually don't listen to them. It's just natural. So then you don't learn anything from them. And they may have a lot to teach you, you know. So we see that in ourselves and we see it in others. My brother told me this once, because my brother was kind of like this, and he realized it, and he said he bought a farm, the classical musician who bought a farm and had a cattle ranch, and he was quite successful at it. But he finally got to a point in his life where he said, well, I got smart enough to finally listen to these people. You know, he listened to them and he learned stuff from them, and he read a lot of books too. So he actually did better than some of those guys did, even, because he kind of put together their wisdom with his book learning. But, you know, he doesn't always like that. And so it was cool to see that he found that, wow, there's another way to do this. If everybody in the class knows how much or little you know, there cannot be any pretense. One time as a first-year undergraduate at the University of Virginia, I was waiting at a bus stop with a friend from the dorm. As people passed by, I greeted several of them. My friend asked me how I knew so many people. And I told him they were acquaintances from my German class. I subsequently got a big fat F in German. Do you ever take a language class? It's pretty apparent what you know and don't know. You can't hide a thing. I knew those kids because in language classes like that, everybody knows each other and everybody knows how much you know. You have to drop your pretense that you know something, because your ignorance is going to be on full display. Debate classes are like that too. What I'm trying to say is that in the long run, you will learn more if you treat all of life like one of those classes. I think that's pretty good. Yeah. Okay. Don't worry about being profound. Hopefully that will come in time. Just be right. Just say things that are defensible. When you give an example of something, be precise. Do not say that a blue car is something that is blue, but not the color of cloth. That is not at all clear. It is the color of a blue car that is blue, but not a color of cloth. A blue car is a big chunk of metal, glass, plastic, and so on. And though it has color, it is not a color. You may continue to wonder whether or not a blue car is blue, but who could question whether or not the color of a blue car is blue? That would be ridiculous. Okay, develop the habit of giving very specific subjects. This is something different from being precise. What I mean is, give a subject such as the color of my father's old blue car, or the color of my blue t-shirt, like you did tonight, the color of the Anagarika's jacket or something. That was a good subject. I can see where I have a lot to learn in this. The reason for this is that it will be easier in the long run to give reasons that justify your assertions. For instance, why is the color of my blue t-shirt a color of cloth? Why? because of being the color of a blue t-shirt. This habit will prove to be helpful down the road, round the way. If we were smart enough, it probably already would have been. Okay. Finally, remember to be consistent in what you are talking about. Most words have multiple meanings, but when you are comparing two things, you cannot surf between different meanings. This is where this is easy to do. And so they give an example here. But anyway, he says, if you do, you end up with too many balls up in the air and it will not be manageable. For instance, suppose you were talking about the subject Coke, C-O-K-E, and consider whether or not it is a mineral. And considering whether or not it is a mineral. So what you're comparing is the subject Coke. So that's the subject. Considering whether or not it's a mineral. Just hearing the sound Coke, it's not exactly clear. It's not clear exactly what is being referred to, the popular soft drink, cocaine, or the carbon material that is a byproduct of coal. Because all of those we call Coke, right? Do you know that in your language? Okay, so Coca-Cola, we call that Coke. And cocaine, the slang is Coke. And then also a byproduct of coal is called Coke. So you have these three separate objects that we have the same label for. So if you were having a debate with somebody and you were slipping back and forth between what you were referring to, he's saying you have like too many balls up in the air and you won't be able to manage it. He says, then what happens is sometimes people will be sly and say something as, Coke is not a mineral. It is a powdery plant-based substance. Then what are you supposed to do? Try to argue that cocaine is a mineral? Of course not. This is just sleight of hand. The only possible purpose of such statements is an attempt either to derail the conversation or to be funny. Okay, so let me go back to one other thing. We have a little bit of time. So another person wrote in. I was trying to explain the example of permanent space because it comes up so much. And I was wondering about that example that I was reading in that book, and I couldn't really find it in the other place of talking about a cup, you know, the space inside of a cup. And when you say this is what's hard, is when you read these books, they're talking along about permanent phenomena and uncaused space or uncompounded space, but they don't always preface it with uncompounded space, you know, every time. So in that sentence, it just says space. So you might say, the space inside the gong comes into existence when the gong does, and it goes out of existence when the gong goes out of existence. And if we haven't got any context for this, you actually don't know, am I talking about compounded space or uncompounded space? There's no way to know because I haven't made it clear. But in the example, in these books, they're usually talking about uncompounded space because they use this as an example a lot. So anyway, a friend wrote in and said, because I was like, wow, is that just, where did that example come from? Because I couldn't find it. It happens to be in our book. So she said, read page 154. So I thought I would. So a permanent phenomena that exists for an occasion is one that is reckoned in relation to a non-eternal phenomena. Okay. Permanent means something that is a phenomena that is non-momentary. So it's not changing moment by moment, right? It's one that's in relation to a non-eternal phenomena. So it doesn't mean it's eternal. You can have something that's not changing moment by moment that comes into existence and goes out of existence. It's just that when it is existing, it's not changing moment by moment. But it doesn't mean it's eternal. The way we use these words in this tradition, not all other Buddhist traditions do this the same, so you have to be careful. But permanent is a phenomena that's non-momentary, and eternal means something that, you know, lasts forever. So those are, and Venerable's very careful with this. She always uses permanent in that way, and she always uses eternal in that way. And not everyone does that. Okay, so we get the first sentence. For instance, one of the stock examples of a permanent phenomena is uncomposed space or uncompounded space or uncaused space. So he's using uncomposed space, all the same, which is identified as the absence of obstructive contact. Uncomposed space is not the same as created space, like when you step back from someone who is standing too close or when a bottle maker provides a liter of space inside the bottle. Rather, uncomposed space is an abstract absence, a lack of obstructive contact. Space is the all-pervading, and then he has a quote, space is all-pervading because there is an absence of obstructive contact everywhere, even where solid objects exist. For without an absence of obstructive contact, an obstructive object could not be there in the first place. So we went through that before. The lack of obstructive contact is everywhere. It's where this phone is, it's where this is, it's where in between, it's up, down, below. So there's, and it's, do you get that? It allows things to be there, is one way you could say it. Because if there was something there, it couldn't be there. That they give that as an example, but it can be confusing. So uncomposed space itself is an abiding and stable permanent phenomena. However, the uncomposed space reckoned in relation to a non-eternal phenomena, such as the inside of a bottle, is a non-eternal permanent phenomena that exists for an occasion. So basically, they're saying that the space inside of a bottle, which is, you know, this isn't eternal, it's going to come into existence and go out of existence. When you're speaking about the uncomposed space, that comes into existence when this comes into existence, and it goes out when that goes out. And so the way I like to think of it is that it helps me, it's helped me a lot to be less confused, is to realize that uncomposed, compounded space, uncomposed space is something that you know through conception. You don't see it. You don't directly see it. The space, when we see space between you and me, that space that I'm seeing, that's, we're talking about cause space. But uncompounded space is something, it's a concept of the mind that you know it through conception, the lack of obstructability. So for the duration of the life of the bottle, that uncomposed space within it is stable and unchanging. Once the bottle is destroyed, it is no longer suitable to speak of the space inside of the bottle. You see, it's because permanent phenomena have parts. So you can talk about the part of uncompounded space that's inside there and outside there, left over this side of the room, that side of the room, because permanent phenomena have parts. Does that make any sense? Maybe that's not helpful. To me, this is helpful. Okay. On to the next sentence. We can remember it in our recollection that the bottle had space inside of it is clear, but the bottle is no longer a bottle, and so the uncomposed space inside of it went out of existence when the bottle was destroyed. How could you talk about the uncompounded space inside of this when it doesn't exist? It'd be pretty hard to do. That's all they're saying. Thanks. Help me out here.
I wish I could. I would venture to say that the uncomposed space that is in that area, mm-hmm. That's labeled or described as a direction of inside the bottle, yeah. is still there. It's just that you don't now label it the uncomposed space inside the bottle.
I completely agree with you. Okay. Yeah, it's got to be everywhere, but you're not labeling it that way.
Yeah, it's like finding a direction or finding a location, but uncompounded space exists all the time everywhere. It's never destroyed.
Right. So. Yeah. That's where I think that helps to think of it as a conceptual thing for me a lot. And then they go on in that thing to how we infer, or not explicitly and implicitly. And implicitly we know, because we do know about where this is. We implicitly know about that. We actually, I don't know what they're saying there. I should read that again. I won't go there. I don't want to confuse anybody. It works for me, but it might not work for you. Anyway, does anyone have any questions or comments? Do you want to do any exercises? Yeah, go ahead. We got a couple. We could do some exercises if people want to.
So in this example, he's referring to the space inside the bottle, both as created space and as uncompounded space.
Yeah, he's used both, yeah.
But
Yeah, two spaces, and he uses both in this example. He talks about the created space inside of the bottle in the beginning of the paragraph, and then he talks about the compounded space and then the uncompounded space, or he's using the word composed. So the one that's impermanent, made up of what? They don't describe it too much. Gases, molecules, oxygen. I hope there's some oxygen there. That you see or don't see. That's the part. Do you actually see it? Or do you see... I don't know. They don't talk about this that much that I've seen.
He seems to be referring to them both as permanent in different ways. One, permanent but not abiding, like occasional impermanence of the created space that's not changing, and the permanent uncompounded space.
So you're saying he's talking about the created space as permanent.
He's comparing two kinds of permanent phenomena. I think that's the point of the whole paragraph.
I would say he's talking about three kinds of space. There's the composed space inside that's impermanent, and then there's the occasional uncompounded space that is there as long as the gong is there or the bottle. And then there's the enduring, or what is it?
Eternal
uncompounded space that is always there, that's never destroyed or changed.
I'm not exactly sure what your question is there, but the created space is not a permanent phenomena. It's not a permanent phenomena. It's an impermanent phenomena. Created space. He uses the word expression here, created space. He says uncomposed space is not the same as created space. Yeah, he does talk about all three, because he talks about space is all pervading because there's an absence of obstructive contact everywhere, and that is eternal. And then he talks about exactly what Venerable Seppel said. He talks about the example of the one inside, both of them inside of the bottle. One he's talking about impermanent space, one he's talking about permanent space. So,
right, so he says, so uncomposed space itself is an abiding and stable permanent phenomena. However, the uncomposed space reckoned in relation to a non-eternal phenomena, such as the inside of a bottle, is a non-eternal permanent phenomena that exists for an occasion. So that is, yeah.
Right, still talking about uncomposed space.
So the examples are the uncomposed space. Yeah. That's correct.
Okay, I think we got it. Thank you. So that means that there are permanent phenomena that exist.
It was really helpful, Venerable Seppel, when you said he's talking about three different spaces. Because I was tracking it until I got to the last sentence and I went, whoa. So when you said he's talking about three different things, then I suddenly said, oh, okay, now I see what the last sentence is talking about, two kinds of uncomposed space. And then he was also talking about created space in terms of what was created when you created the bottle. And that's never permanent. And the other one is permanent, but it's, as he calls it, for an occasion.
Occasional.
And also the fact you say we quit labeling it as inside the bottle and the bottle goes away. So those are both really helpful for me.
And you use a label. So, okay. We'll do an exercise just for fun. Okay, page 9 and 10. Oh, another question, sorry.
This could be an exercise. Okay. How do the two compare? The category of causes and the category of effects?
A category.
Because I know that in one instance, a cause and an effect are mutually exclusive because a cause has to cease before the effect comes into being. But all effects are a cause of something else, and causes produce effects. So a cause are the category causes and the category effects mutually inclusive?
Yeah, well, let's do it Venerable's way. What's an example of something that's both?
One moment of mind is the effect of the previous moment of mind and the cause for the next moment of mind.
Yeah, this is the same thing that we gave to Geshe Dadul about the karma, and I found something that said that these definitely are not... I was trying to say that they were the same, and they definitely weren't. They were related, cause and effect were related, but they don't, the instance, anyway, so, but the category, see, you're talking about categories, you're not talking, so you haven't, I don't know if you've given it an instant yet. I'm not so clear that you've given an instant that is both of the category of causes and the category of effects.
One moment of mind.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Moment of mind. Okay, mm-hmm. Do we accept that? The category of causes.
One moment of mind comes under the category of a cause. Because one moment of mind is an instance of a cause.
One moment of mind is not a category.
No, but it's an instance of the cat. Wait. One moment of mind is an instance of the category of causes. Because one moment of mind is the cause for the next moment of mind.
But you're not...
But one moment of mind is also an instance of a category, of the category and effect.
Right.
Because it's the effect of the previous moment of mind.
But then you're not comparing categories. Yeah, right. And I don't think that... I don't think that is for... Yeah, but I don't think... Personally, I don't believe that what you're saying works. And I'll say it, and go ahead. The way you just explained that is exactly the thing I tried to say to Geshe Dadul. And when you say the category of causes, you're actually talking about causes there. And you're saying the collective entity causes. And so this, I was trying to say to Geshe Dadul, aren't these things just categories, the collective entities? And he said, no, you wouldn't accept that from me. So when you talk about, let's go back a little bit. We might not get this, but this is where I've had a lot of confusion. And I have to go to simpler examples. Chairs is a collective category. So... collective category. What's the word they use? It's because there's different words they use in these books, but he had one word he used here. Where do we start tonight? Yeah, collective. The category wasn't in there, was it? Let me go back and look. Where did we start tonight? Collective entities, right. So, do you want to say the collective entities of causes, the collective entity of effects? Right. That's actually what you're comparing when you say that. The collective entity of the collective entity of causes might work. Yeah, I think you have to say just causes. I think what you're speaking about is causes.
I am. I'm just trying to avoid the... I know that cause and its effect are mutually exclusive.
Right.
But yes, my question is, are causes and effects mutually inclusive?
Yeah, and this is like how he answered our question, which was, when you're speaking abstractly, then I will give you an abstract answer. So that's what his answer was to this. It's a really similar kind of question. So when we asked the question, it was very similar to that. It's an abstract. He said, this is too abstract of a question, because... this was his answer to us. I mean, you can transcribe it and see. And I'll give you an abstract answer to handle it. Yeah. But we were comparing the effect of dukkha and the causes of dukkha. Yeah. Matt understood what he said better than I did.
After asking, he continued pressing us for an instance until we were talking about a hyper-specific instance. So when you're talking about a nature of mind, and then you're talking about, an instance of mind, what you're actually comparing is a previous instance of mind and a forward-looking instance of mind. No.
So you have to give a. This is where we went into trouble. And so try. Let's see, because I agree with him.
I'm comparing one instant of
okay,
mind.
Okay, but you have to what instance? You have to say more. You have to say more about it. This is where the subject is not specific enough. So. Yeah, he kept pressing
specific.
This.
And then until we gave a specific answer, he just kept it very abstract.
I would venture to say that there was a context to that conversation that's different than what she's asking right now. Mm. She's just asking, how did the two compare, causes and effects?
And the answer would be mutually exclusive.
Mutually inclusive, actually. Their cause and whatever is a cause is necessarily an effect, and whatever is an effect is necessarily a cause.
I don't think so.
Well, this is what we'll I've go, learned. This
please,
is what I've had.
I'll explain why. First, say it and explain why. Give an instance
okay,
of both.
She gave. This is our habit: is that we go into justification. We give too many words, you know. But what she was saying, I would agree with, which is that okay. So the instance you said, what is something that's both? It would be a cause. It would also be an effect. One moment of mind is, as she said, the result of the previous moment of mind. It's also it's the effect because it's the effect of a previous moment of mind, and it's the cause of the next moment.
Right,
of mind.
And this is exactly the same argument that I gave to Geshe Dado. Exactly.
Okay, well, we'll need to go into this further. But if you look into
I see what you're saying.
Let's look in debate, because I'll bet you'll find that debate says the two words are mutually inclusive, or synonymous at least. I'm not sure if there's a difference between those two things.
There is, which was what he went over last week in the book. But let's hear everybody's views. This is good.
So,
this is what we have to get clearer.
This came out of our practice session.
Mm-hmm.
And so... what I was quoting from one of the books on the mind that I was reading, mm-hmm. that one of the, I think it was Geshe Raptan, but I won't swear to that. And he said, he was talking about subjects and objects.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, a particular subject and a particular object are mutually exclusive. But all subjects are also objects.
Right.
So then we said, well, what are other cases where we
I don't have any disagreement with most of what you're saying.
Then we said, what about cause and effect? Because a particular pair of cause and effect are mutually exclusive, but a thing that is a cause is as...
I don't disagree with what you're saying, any of you are saying there.
Right.
I don't disagree with you at all. I just think that it's hard for me to forget what it seems so similar. It seems exactly the same question that I posed to Geshe Dado.
You said with Geshe Dado you were talking about the causes and effects of dukkha.
Right.
Yeah. So here we're talking about just causes and effects. And if we went through the questions,
mm-hmm.
like you could say a single moment of mind, or you could even say this moment of mind,
mm-hmm.
you know, or, you know, you could say this book.
Mm-hmm.
It is the effect of it's the result of the previous moment of book, and it's the cause of the next moment of book, even with physical phenomena.
Right. I have no disagreement
so
with that.
So then can we find anything that is a cause that is not an effect? Or anything that's an effect that's not a cause.
But then you're comparing the same phenomena, and you can't do that in this system. You have to compare two different... The things have to be different.
Hold on.
Let's go back to... What I understand in this system is that when we compare phenomena, that they have to be different.
How would you go about... products and impermanent phenomena. How would you go about proving that those two are mutually inclusive?
But the examples you give are different.
Sure.
So when you say, okay, just use P and Q, okay? We're not even going to talk about particular P and Q. But what do you ask the question? Is there anything that is both P and Q? And you go, yes, the subject X.
Right.
Is both P and Q.
Right.
So if you say if you substitute the word causes and you for P and effects, mm-hmm.
Okay, I see what you guys are doing now. Okay. Yeah, I get what you're doing.
I think this is because we're jumping ahead and this is later material. But it does say in Daniel Perdue's debate book at what we're saying, although cause and effect in general are mutually inclusive, if these are applied to a specific basis, they are mutually exclusive. Yeah. So this is page 536. Although I'm not seeing his presentation of proving cause and effect in general being mutually inclusive, but you know, he's pointing out later that he just goes into how cause of pot has to cease before effect of pot.
So, but what would be an example? So would a moment of mind work? Yeah.
What was Geshe Dado's answer?
He said we were being too abstract.
So.
Yeah, mutually exclusive.
Well, then, yeah, that's
because
exactly.
Because he's saying you weren't getting to a specific example.
Right, so then that's basically what she said.
All right, so yeah, when you get, yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense to me. But I would like to know, I'd have to think about what, I can't get that example exactly to work, but I can't really think, so there we go. Sorry. It works for you, doesn't work for me.
With it being a specific example, if you're saying what is the cause and the of the moment of a moment of mind and the effect of the same moment of mind, they would be mutually exclusive. But to use a moment of mind in the example of comparing causes and effects is not what that's referring to. It's referring to if you were comparing the cause and effect of a specific item.
I guess I'm just so kind of, what would the word be? Marinated in things that are more specific examples that I'm having a hard time with the, that's helpful, but I see my mind kind of not walking over there so well.
Yeah, I think that it's a good thing to look at in the long run, even if we think about it later, because it really shows the connectedness of everything. That everything that is a cause is an effect of something previous, and everything that's an effect is a cause of something else. And you can look at like how we know of matter, and nothing goes out of existence, and we don't say there's any beginning. The matter doesn't go out of existence. Even if you had a glass jar and it got crushed to glass powder.
Yeah, I don't have any trouble with that.
Right.
That doesn't really solve it for me.
But
I get it.
I think that's what it helps show, is that everything has a continuum and an interdependence.
Well, you know, this is the thing where it's ripe for the student.
Right.
You know, that's what, and for mine, I don't have a qualm about that, so my qualm has more to do with, I have a lot of qualms about how this process works and about what you're talking about. I have a lot of confusion. This is what I was trying to clarify with Geshe Dado. I have a lot of confusion about the subjects, actually, and it's quite a big topic, and so I can't go very quickly in that because, you know, I can't make that work. Okay, now we can stop, hey? It's been a long day. Okay, that was fun. We got through the chapter, I think, which is what we were trying to do. And that was a good, I like to be thought-provoking questions, so that was good. Thank you, everybody. That's the point, thinking. But we are really jumping ahead. But that's okay. I don't have any problem with that. I think it's good. And I think Daniel Perdue does too. He says we're going to get some more points for our next life. So we just got a few. Okay, so thank you, everyone. And let's take a moment to just appreciate sharing together and our opportunity to do this. I think actually for me, it makes me really see when we get into syllogisms that a syllogism only applies to the person who's pondering the thing. And so it's interesting to me how parts of this work, or some that don't. And then there's just so many facets to this. I thought this would all be a lot easier, actually, when I started looking at the debate, reading this debate book, and I was just surprised, like, how many distinctions they make. And I think that we need to be able to make these distinctions. So may our minds grow in this way so that we can do this and help each other along the way and get to a place where we actually can realize the nature of reality. And may we use that to purify our minds completely so we'll be in a better situation of being able to benefit others. So let's then dedicate.